Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hi, everybody. A big immigration vote is coming tonight in the Senate, but even the Mexican border troop surge may not cut it in the House. The Farm Bill is stuck over a work requirement for food stamp recipients. President Obama plans to unveil climate change executive orders tomorrow. But the questions stealing most of the headlines: where in the world is Edward Snowden? And what in the world was David Gregory thinking, asking Glenn Greenwald if he's a journalist or a felon? We will try to get to all these topics to start the show today with Molly Ball, who covers national politics for The Atlantic. She's been writing about how social conservatives still rule the GOP and how Democrats might actually be able to win elections in the Deep South. We'll see. And we'll talk about those stories, too. Hey, Molly, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, we'll open the phones on a few of these topics as we go. We've got a nice long time with Molly Ball today, and our first invitation is for anyone from Ecuador. I know Snowden was not on that flight, but he is expected to fly to Ecuador and seek asylum there. Ecuadorians in the New York area, why does your country of origin give asylum to Julian Assange from WikiLeaks, and why might it now to Edward Snowden, reportedly seeking asylum there later today? Why does your country do this, and do you like the idea? If you're Ecuadorian, please call in, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I bet we do have some Ecuadorians, and you can clear up for me whether it's Ecuadorians or Ecuadorians in our area. So call us if you're listening, 212-433-9692. And Molly, while those calls are coming in, I want to replay the moment from the Sunday talk shows yesterday that really blew up on Twitter and other social media. As you know, it's David Gregory on Meet the Press with Glenn Greenwald from The Guardian on if Greenwald should be prosecuted as a criminal for his role in helping the NSA leaker Edward Snowden. We'll play the whole extraordinary exchange. It's under a minute and a half. So listen to the question. Listen to Greenwald lash out at Gregory for being a journalist who muses if other journalists should be prosecuted for their work. And listen to Gregory reply by saying Greenwald's status as a journalist in this case is up for debate. Here we go.
To the extent that you have aided and abetted Snowden, even in his current movements, why shouldn't you, Mr. Greenwald, be charged with a crime?
I think it's pretty extraordinary that anybody who would call themselves a journalist would publicly muse about whether or not other journalists should be charged with felonies. The assumption in your question, David, is completely without evidence, the idea that I've aided and abetted him in any way. The scandal that arose in Washington before our stories began was about the fact that the Obama administration is trying to criminalize investigative journalism by going through the emails and phone records of AP reporters, accusing a Fox News journalist of the theory that you just embraced, being a co-conspirator with felonies for working with sources. If you want to embrace that theory, it means that every investigative journalist in the United States who works with their sources, who receives classified information, is a criminal. And it's precisely those theories and precisely that climate that has become so menacing in the United States. It's why the New Yorker's Jane Mayer said investigative reporting has come to a standstill, her word, as a result of the theories that you just referenced.
Well, the question of who's a journalist may be up to a debate with regard to what you're doing. And of course, anybody who's watching this understands I was asking a question. That question has been raised by lawmakers as well. I'm not embracing anything, but obviously I take your point.
David Gregory and Glenn Greenwald on Meet the Press. And I invite other journalists to call in as well and weigh in on that exchange. What were you thinking when you saw David Gregory go at Glenn Greenwald that way and Greenwald go back at him the way he did? 212-433-WNYC. So it's Ecuadorians and journalists invited to call in right now, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. And the journalist with us as a guest is Molly Ball, national politics writer for The Atlantic. And I don't know if you want to weigh in on this, Molly. The
Sure.
Washington Post covers the story today by saying Greenwald has taken an advocacy role for Snowden, but there is no evidence he has helped Snowden evade U.S. authorities seeking his arrest. So assuming that's true, then personally, I don't see any question but that Greenwald was acting as a journalist. He's an opinion journalist. He's an advocacy journalist. Like many columnists are, Gregory called him a polemicist, which I agree with. But that's still within the definition of journalism. It seems pretty clear to me. Have you and your colleagues been kicking this around over the last day?
Oh, absolutely. And you've seen a very lively debate about this on social media as well. I'm a fan of tough questioning. I think it's okay, especially with a source who is a public figure, and we can talk about whether Glenn Greenwald meets that definition or is just sort of the messenger in this case. But as you say, he has a role in this debate. He's taken a side in this debate. I think it's okay for him to be questioned aggressively and given an opportunity to make a sort of robust defense of his role in this story. The whole debate around Snowden is so incredibly polarized and inflamed, and you really do have a large segment of the population that thinks he is a hero and a large segment of the population that thinks he is a traitor. And so, you know, for everyone involved in this story to be given an opportunity to explain, you know, sort of what they think they're doing and why they are on the side that they're on, I think is appropriate. I think for David Gregory, you know, when you're also a public face as a journalist, your credibility matters too. So perhaps the way he posed the question could have been clearer that he did not intend to take a side, because that is potentially damaging for him too.
Yeah. I mean, it was Long Island Congressman Peter King who first suggested that Greenwald could be charged. I guess that's why David Gregory brought it up. I don't really blame Gregory personally for getting Greenwald's reaction to Peter King on the record. But what bothered me was that Gregory then said in his follow-up question, as if it was his own judgment, that the question of whether Greenwald is a journalist is up in the air in this case. And if all he did was receive and edit and report information that he cares about and did not help Snowden avoid capture, it is not up in the air. So I don't know if he was just ad-libbing his way through in the follow-up question and he would take that back, but I thought that was further than he needed to go.
Yeah, I think probably he could have he could have phrased it better. What I took that to mean was this is a matter of public debate, not that there is some question in his, David Gregory's, mind, but that there are, as you say, there are lawmakers questioning this. There is, as Glenn Greenwald said, an administration, a presidential administration, that has described journalists as criminal co-conspirators in legal documents. So there is certainly a very well-credentialed school of thought that is describing journalists that way.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, you're referring to the case of that Fox News reporter the other week, James Rosen, who got a story about North Korea from a State Department source, and FBI documents mused that Rosen could be charged under the Espionage Act just for helping the leaker to leak to him. I didn't remember anybody asking James Rosen on a Sunday talk show if he's a journalist, but all right, enough of that. WikiLeaks, by the way, I'll add this and get your reaction. WikiLeaks, which has purported to be a news organization too, and says that's why Julian Assange shouldn't be charged under the Espionage Act, and that's why Ecuador gave him asylum, I guess. That's a WikiLeaks official was explicitly helping Snowden to leave Hong Kong yesterday, according to news reports, and go to Russia, and now presumably eventually to Ecuador to seek asylum. Did you see that? And do you think that crosses a different kind of line?
In my mind, it does. But, I mean, I'm not the sort of judge and jury here, right? It's
not
to me
to decree
who's a journalist and who isn't.
Right.
Yeah, in my opinion, it does. But
to
I
me
think,
too.
But I think what it shows also is that these are complicated questions. It's not as black and white as saying anyone who is leaked to, you know, must be immune from any kind of judgment, because there are actors who are much more involved. And I think the WikiLeaks case is a case in point of as you say, an organization and a person that has been much more activist and worked with its sources in a way that does cross that line that Greenwald has said he didn't.
By the way, for the record, I looked it up. The Guardian's website describes Greenwald as a columnist on civil liberties and U.S. national securities issues for The Guardian and a former constitutional lawyer. Wikipedia describes him as an American political journalist, lawyer, columnist, blogger, and author. Greenwald's own Twitter profile says columnist and blogger for The Guardian, author of With Liberty and Justice for Some, Dog and Animal Fanatic, Retweet Doesn't Equal Endorsement. Well, we all say that about our retweets. All right.
Well,
go ahead.
If I could just make one more point, I think it's one of the glories of American journalism and journalism in a free society that it is a free-for-all, that it is that we're not a licensed profession, right, that has to take a sort of bar-like exam and have either the government or some other body say you're a journalist and you're not. And so there's some ambiguity that comes in. We've seen cases of whether bloggers are journalists, whether citizen journalists, quote-unquote, get those same First Amendment protections. But I would say it would be a bad idea to go in the other direction toward a sort of rigid definition of who does and doesn't get that freedom of the press.
And by the way, I also looked up Ecuador this morning on the CIA website. The CIA describes Ecuador as a republic with an elected president every 4 years with term limits the same as ours, 2 terms. Also, voting is compulsory in Ecuador for people 18 to 65. I didn't know that, but the CIA told me so. And the currency, you know what currency they use in Ecuador?
I believe it's a dollarized.
It is the U.S. dollar. Mm-hmm. So on that note, Victor in Queens, Ecuadorian originally, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in, sir.
Yes, sir. Look, I believe that Mr. Snowden, as well as Mr. Julian Assange, should be given the Nobel Peace Prize.
Why?
For publicizing the lies that the United States government is perpetrating around the world and spying on its own citizens. I think that this is a service not only to the American people, but to mankind worldwide. So on that base, on that ground, these individuals should deserve the Nobel Peace Prize. As a matter of fact, as Jesus Christ said, the truth will set you free. And that's what we stand for. And that's what should be done. That's why they should deserve the Nobel Peace Prize.
Victor, thank you very much. Another Ecuadorian caller, John in Jersey. John, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Well, I think someone corrected you already, but yeah, it's Ecuadorian.
Got it.
And second of all, I do believe that Ecuador, with the under Correa's leadership,
the current president Correa,
Yeah, President Correa, right? They've become well aware of the corruption that's going on, that's been going on for years in this country, and that's why they would offer asylum to whistleblowers like Julian Assange and now Edward Snowden. Hopefully, they do allow them to stay there. But it's sad that they're being persecuted for just speaking out the truth, and I don't like the way this country is going.
John, thank you. Adam, calling from the Cayman Islands, wants to defend David Gregory. Adam, thanks for calling us again. How are you doing down there today?
I'm doing good, and I just want to let you know Snowden isn't here. So,
as far as you know. But a lot of Americans' money is, but that's another show.
Yeah. Blah, blah.
But go ahead. You want to defend David Gregory? Do it.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I'm living down here. I don't have cable, and I watch everything on the Internet, and I do not miss the screaming talking head style of network TV. But, you know, I think it was a fair question to ask. He did ask it in that kind of screaming crossfire style of being so accusatory. I thought that was a mistake, but I mean, I've heard Greenwald before respond to criticism, and I think he can be very
he's combative
whiny and not accept criticism well. And I think that he, you know, he should be let it roll off his back a little more and answer the question. I mean, it's a fair question. I don't agree that he should be prosecuted, but I think it's a fair question, and I think he should let his ego not get in the way as much and just answer the question and not get into he's. participating in the same screaming talking head tactics by going back at Gregory like that.
Adam, thank you for checking in. I appreciate it. We'll take a break, then we'll continue with Molly Ball from The Atlantic. We'll go on to some other things, including the big immigration vote coming tonight in the Senate. We do now have an affirmative action ruling from the Supreme Court. We'll bring you the latest on that. So stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, this just coming in from the Supreme Court on the affirmative action case that they were deciding. The AP says they have decided to send the case back to a lower court. I'm looking at SCOTUS blog, a usually very reliable source on the Supreme Court, and they're live blogging the decision announcements this morning. And they say the majority seems to reaffirm that diversity is a compelling interest, if only because that rule was not challenged by the plaintiffs in the case. In other words, this may be getting sent back to a lower court on a technicality. However, Justice Ginsburg is currently reading a dissent as of a minute or so ago. And so if Justice Ginsburg dissents Ruth Bader Ginsburg, then what does that indicate? That the majority really did. They might be more against affirmative action, but this is just being read and read out, and we will give you the details and the clarity as it becomes available through the course of the morning. We continue in the meantime with our conversation with Molly Ball, who covers national politics for The Atlantic. Molly, the immigration bill. Mm-hmm. Now that it includes a troop surge, if we could call it that, of 20,000 Border Patrol agents at the Mexican border for a total of 40,000, plus a commitment to build a 700-mile fence, is it headed for the 70 votes that the sponsors want?
It is certainly headed over the 60-vote threshold. I've heard some very unofficial sort of observer advocate whip counts that put it near 65, 67, and that is just sort of a made-up threshold anyway, right? The idea is just as this border surge is sort of a shock and awe approach to border security, the idea is to create an impression of overwhelming bipartisan agreement and momentum in the Senate that hopefully, in the hope of immigration reform advocates, would sort of force the House to come to the table. I think the problem with that idea, the sort of basis for that idea, is that we've seen the House have no respect for overwhelming bipartisan unity in the Senate. We've seen multiple times the Senate has passed things by overwhelming margins, whether it was the fiscal cliff deal or just last week the farm bill, and the House nonetheless rejects them or dissolves into chaos and is unable to get them through.
And even in the Senate, Jeff Sessions from Alabama, David Vitter from Louisiana, James Inhofe from Oklahoma, Ted Cruz from Texas, these Deep South senators are still vocally opposed to the bill. Cruz is Latino, but there's this thought, I saw David Brooks say this on TV over the weekend and others, that the border security question is being resolved. Most economists think this is good for the United States in terms of economics. And so maybe it comes down to those who still fear cultural change in the United States from a lot of immigration, especially from Mexico. So let me play a minute of Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama, talking the other day about why he still opposes this bill, even with the new border security measures.
Bob, Hispanics are here today by the millions. They're working in the $20,000 to $40,000 income level. Their wages will be impacted adversely. Their ability to get a job, to get a job with retirement benefits and health care benefits, somebody needs to speak up for them. And I really believe that the numbers in the bill, the lack of enforcement effectiveness in the bill, puts us in a position where it will impact all Americans that are out there working today adversely. And the CBO has said that. The Federal Reserve in Atlanta has said that. Harvard economists have said that. There's really little doubt about that. And so I think we move away from ethnic politics. And we try to appeal to all people based on what's best for America and for them.
Jeff Sessions. And Molly, I thought that was really an incredible clip. He starts by appealing directly to Hispanics, saying their ability to get a job, to get a job with retirement benefits and health care benefits. Somebody needs to speak up for them. Jeff Sessions, we finally found somebody to speak up for Hispanics in America. And then he goes on to say, I think we move away from the ethnic politics and we try to appeal to all people based on what's best for America and for them. So one way or the other, whether he's appealing directly to Hispanics or saying we should forget about Hispanics, he's kind of making an ethnic appeal.
Well, what immigration reform is really about, the soul of the bill and what it's always come down to, is the path to citizenship for illegal immigrants who are currently in the United States. And there are people like the senators whose names you mentioned who just don't believe in that. And I'm not going to impugn their motives or say they're racist, but what the what a lot of national Republicans fear is that that point of view that we just – which is sort of insurmountable by any amount of border security, right? They're sort of not willing to trade their opposition for anything. And what a lot of Republicans fear is that that will get turned around on the party as a whole, as we've seen happen in at least the last two presidential elections, to make the case to Hispanic citizens that this is a party that opposes them, as you say, on the basis of ethnicity. And that has proved pretty powerful with the Hispanic vote in the last couple of elections.
And I noticed that you published a piece on The Atlantic yesterday musing about whether the Democrats could win elections in the Deep South. You think they can in the land of Inhofe and Sessions and David Vitter?
Well, I don't think it's as far-fetched as you might think. And the sort of news peg for this piece was a little-noticed municipal election in Mississippi a few weeks ago where the state Republican Party, the Mississippi Republicans, worked very hard to take four different mayoral elections that are sort of Republican strongholds in Mississippi, and the Democratic Party, the Democratic candidate, won them all. Democrats have a sort of new model, a new formula in the South that involves, number one, the demographic changes happening there. All of the fastest growing Hispanic populations in the United States are Southern states. You also have a growing Black population in all of these states due in part to a remigration of African Americans back to the South. And so you have the demographics of all these states changing, and Republicans in the view of Democrats overreaching and going too far in the sort of conservative Tea Party direction. They believe that that is the formula that will enable them to start winning back voters for Democrats in the South.
I've heard it with respect to Texas before, obviously sharing a long border with Mexico, and that as in some other Western states already, there might be enough Mexicans in Texas before too long for the Democrats to be competitive in that state and statewide elections. I hadn't heard it before about Alabama, Mississippi, and along there, so that's really interesting. But how do you explain Ted Cruz to people in the New York area who may not be familiar with him? Why is he not going the same route as Marco Rubio, Latino Republican senator, trying to broker the immigration bill and still yet maintain his very conservative credentials for a very possible presidential run in the future? Ted Cruz, though he's Latino too, is saying no, 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 no. Why the difference?
Well, I think there's a couple things. I think, first of all, Ted Cruz it comes from the Tea Party, comes from the far conservative wing of the party. That's how he got where he is. He went up against an establishment candidate in the Texas primary. Incredibly expensive, I think $30 million spent in this primary. And Ted Cruz, who was sort of the shoestring candidate, the sort of plucky ideological candidate, managed to dethrone this incredibly well-funded establishment candidate in that primary on the basis of being so staunchly conservative and appealing to the conservatism of Texas Republican voters, which is they are quite, quite conservative. And so he sees this as of a piece with that stance. I think it's also probably a factor that Ted Cruz is Cuban-American, not Mexican-American or some other type of Hispanic.
Rubio's Cuban too, right?
Rubio is Cuban too, and obviously has has come to a different position on this, but I do think there's much more of a tradition in the Cuban American population of conservatism, of siding with the Republican Party, and it's also the case that they don't face the same challenges for gaining citizenship as a lot of other Hispanic immigrants do.
And listeners, anybody who still opposes the immigration bill, who is a skeptic of immigration reform and who is not moved by the border security measures that got agreed to last week at the request of some other conservative Republicans in the Senate, if you're still not moved, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Andrew on the Upper East Side might be one of those people. Hi, Andrew. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Brian. Yes, I am a liberal Democrat. I'm not moved by this immigration reform. Obviously, we've had 30 years of broken promises on this issue. The government does not enforce the current laws. And these reports from these GOA and everything do not reflect the reality that you have stagnating wages. You have you don't have jobs to for these people to come in because you're going to let in about, what, 30 million people? Who are going to promote their family over here. And Americans are not inherently stupid, as politicians and elitists think they are.
Well, you get the economists pretty much all over the map, not 100%, but largely from everything I've read and heard, who say immigrants create jobs faster than they take other people's jobs. And that's the history of the United States, certainly the history of New York City. And as America becomes more diverse, there's every reason to expect that that's going to be the case. Plus that the people who tend to immigrate tend to be the most adventurous, the most risk-taking, you know, those kinds of people who might be good for an entrepreneurial economy like ours. And then there's the fact of needing young workers for the worker-to-retiree ratio, since American native-born Americans aren't having babies at a fast enough rate. You want to... You're skeptical about all of that?
Yes, I'm very skeptical about all that. That's not reflecting reality. The global economy and technology has shown us that we don't need as many people as we used to do before. And most of those people that come in and are coming into this country are poor people from third world countries who have no skills, and they're winding up in government programs. That's just the fact.
Well, Molly, go ahead. And Andrew, thank you for your call. Molly, go ahead.
Yeah, I would challenge something else that the caller said, which is that we've had, quote, 30 years of broken promises. That's actually factually not true. Illegal border crossings are at a 40-year low. By a lot of metrics, the southern border is more secure than it has ever been. The number of Border Patrol agents, currently about 20,000, has quadrupled since the 1990s. And the amount of money that the federal government spends on border security, currently about $18 billion, is by far more than they've ever spent in history. So certainly people do still make it across the border. And if absolutely any illegal immigration is too much for you, then I suppose that's unacceptable. But it isn't true to say that the government has only paid lip service to this issue and hasn't done anything about it. In fact, they've done quite a lot about it.
Raphael in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hello, Raphael. Raphael.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Listen to me, not your radio. Raphael will get back to you. Let's try Alex in Mount Olive. Hi, Alex.
How you doing, Brian? First off, I have an issue with saying that illegal immigration crossing has been the lowest 40 years. That's not so much a result of increased border security, but the fact that the economy took a downturn. And the whole discussion of having this being about immigration reform, it's not. It's about providing people that came here illegally with a way to jump ahead of the line and reward them with citizenship. Now, I myself am a Republican, Hispanic, conservative, and I get upset with how we're discussing this issue as being immigration reform. This is solely about providing a way for people that came here illegally with rewarding them, with a citizenship.
Alex, thank you. And Molly, there is a certain political truth to what he says, isn't there, which is that this wouldn't really be coming up were it not for the fact of how crucial Hispanics were to giving President Obama his reelection, and the Republican Party kind of panicking about that. And previously, the Democratic Party realizing that there was a lot to gain and an increasing share of an increasing Latino vote by being for a path to citizenship for millions of people who came here illegally.
Well, it's not an idea that is without a history in the Republican Party, right? George W. Bush was strongly in favor of immigration reform. And coming out of Texas, he and Karl Rove, I think, read the political equation in a similar way.
Exactly. Although I think they got a lot. And Bush, we talked about this on the show last week, Bush got 40% of the 44% of the Latino vote, so much more than McCain or Romney have gotten.
Right. And so that is what has inspired a lot of national Republicans to say, let's get this off the table. An argument I hear from conservatives a lot is, well, Hispanics who are citizens who are here legally don't care about immigration. If you poll them on what their priorities are, first, like everybody else, it's the economy, it's education, it's jobs, it's health care. That's true as far as it goes, but it's a sort of a gateway issue, right? It's an identity issue where if Hispanics see that people who look like them and come from where they come from are, in their perception, being discriminated against or legislated against on an ethnic basis, they react very badly to that. There's a message, according to a lot of polls and studies of the electorate, a message coming out of the Republican Party that these minority groups are hearing that they are not welcome, that they are not liked. And so that makes it impossible for these groups to even hear the Republicans' economic message because they're turned off before they even get in the door.
One more call, and it's Ed in Huntington, who doesn't like this immigration compromise from a different standpoint. Right, Ed?
Yes, I don't approve of it simply because we are going to create another whole agency of 40,000 people to patrol the border. Now, who's going to pay for that? Where is the money coming from? We have troops halfway around the world or all around the world, and we're talking about bringing some of them home. I would say in order to maintain rather than cutting the military budget completely, we could, if we're going to do that, at least use military troops to patrol the border.
Ed, thank you for
We have laws now that they're not enforcing.
Ed, thank you for your call. So, Molly, do you have an answer to him? And this idea of 40,000 Border Patrol agents, I mean, how many troops do we have left in Afghanistan, in a whole country at this point?
Mm-hmm.
What are these 40,000 Border Patrol agents actually going to do? And is it really going to seal the border from people who are trying to sneak in?
I think it's hard to read it as anything other than symbolic. Now, as the caller described it as a new agency, it's not. It's the Border Patrol. But already the Border Patrol has a really hard time hiring people to fill the sort of politically dictated number of agents that they've already been given. And so this will be a tremendous challenge. It would certainly be an irony if they find themselves using the guest worker program to try to staff some of these border positions. I don't even know if that's possible. But, so it's hard to hire this many people. And it is a lot of money. But it's hard for the sort of same conservatives who are arguing that there wasn't enough border security in the bill to then turn around and say it's too much because it's a waste of money. And it's sort of the same people making those two arguments.
Although there are also liberals making that argument that they're shocked and outraged that we would spend money at a time when we're cutting the food stamp program and mm-hmm. can't afford all kinds of things. Can't afford the retirement of the baby boomers, et cetera, that we're going to pay for this, symbolic, as you call it, 40,000-person troop surge on the Mexican border and to build a wall, all to mollify people's irrational fears, as liberals would see it. So there's all of
right.
that.
Right. Well, and rationalization or the reasoning behind it in the Senate has been that because there was that congressional budget office report that you've mentioned that found that there would be these tremendous positive effects for the economy and for the federal budget. That was surprising to a lot of people when that came out last week. And so that gave lawmakers a way to argue, we are just taking money created by immigration reform and putting that back into the border security.
I want to touch one other thing that you wrote about, and my guest is Molly Ball, who writes about national politics for The Atlantic. We just have a minute left, but I think this is important. You wrote a piece this weekend about how social conservatives still control the GOP, even though they seemed to recede in last year's presidential election. They just passed that anti-abortion bill in the House, banning all abortions after 20 weeks, which, of course, won't pass the Senate, won't become law. But I think it wouldn't pass muster with the Supreme Court under Roe versus Wade anyway. But I think in Washington and Albany in the last week, we've learned a lesson about how fragile abortion rights remain in this country. If Republicans win the Senate and the White House, that bill probably becomes law and goes to the Supreme Court, which may be just one presidential election away from the votes to overturn Roe. And in the New York State Legislature, I don't know if you followed this from Washington last week, they failed last week to pass a bill which would have codified Roe into state law just in case it's ever repealed by the Supreme Court. That was in liberal New York. So this is a fragile right indeed in American politics today, isn't it?
We have state legislatures all over the country passing restrictive abortion laws, and that was sort of the inspiration for the House to do what it did. That and the recent trial of the abortion provider in Philadelphia. And so, but what you see is that these social conservatives are so organized and they are so activist that even if they are a minority view of the broader body politic, they are in many cases a majority of the Republican Party and certainly the most mobilized of the activists. And so they still have a lot of clout. They still have a lot of ability to sort of demand things from their representatives and get them to act.
Molly Ball, national correspondent for The Atlantic, writing about national politics. Thank you so much for coming on with me. There was so much to talk about today, and I really appreciate all your time.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, here's the breaking news on the affirmative action case at the Supreme Court. It was a 7-1 decision in which, and I'm reading the Wall Street Journal version here, they avoided a sweeping ruling on affirmative action, deciding to order a new review of a case involving the University of Texas admissions program. The justices returned the case to the lower court. It was the case of Abigail Fisher, who alleged the university rejected her because she is white. The decision, though, was expected to reverberate throughout higher education. Since the 1970s, racial and ethnic diversity has become a central creed in American higher education, and dozens of institutions, from the Ivy League to the military academies, filed briefs backing the University of Texas's program. We will bring you more clarity on what that ruling actually means. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.